You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Maria McKinley.
And I'm Ryan Stacy. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, June 30th, 2016.
Our dancers, choreographers, and or theater artists particularly need to be more entrepreneurial. So many of them simply need to found their own companies, and they do.
A recent survey of arts alumni reveals many feel their professional skills, including an entrepreneurial mindset, are rooted in an arts education. More on that later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks whether Indiana should have a hate crime law. But first, these local headlines.
Earlier today, a federal court granted Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky a preliminary injunction regarding Indiana's new abortion law. House Unruled Act 1337 sought to outlaw abortions that are sought solely because of the race, gender, or disability of the fetus. The law also required providers to communicate certain information to women seeking abortions. U.S. District Court Judge Tanya Walton Pratt stated these regulations were likely unconstitutional. The law also required fetal tissue to be disposed of in a similar fashion to human tissue, which Pratt also said was likely unconstitutional. Governor Mike Pence signed the bill into law in March after the bill passed the legislature. According to court documents, Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky and the American Civil Liberties Union filed suits in April, saying that the law violates the 14th Amendment's concept of personal liberty and the First Amendment right to free speech. The law was to go into effect tomorrow, but this preliminary injunction blocks all further action until the case is settled.
Bloomington police are searching for witnesses and a suspect after an attempted abduction on the Beeline Trail. The incident occurred on Sunday afternoon around noon. According to the Herald Times, Bloomington police said a man grabbed a woman and tried to pull her away from the trail. She wasn't injured, and others on the trail heard the woman screaming and sought help. The suspect was reported to be a white male in his 40s with no facial hair and tattoos on his arms. The suspect has not been found.
A program aimed at saving three endangered languages has taken a Bloomington-based nonprofit group to North Dakota this summer. WFHB News Director Joe Crawford has more on that story.
The Language Conservancy is a Bloomington-based nonprofit organization formed with the mission to save Native American languages in danger of disappearing. To do this, they work in conjunction with Native American tribes to create tools such as textbooks in order to teach and pass on the languages. Here's Wilhelm Maya, the executive director for the Language Conservancy.
So the Language Conservancy has usually partners with tribes, colleges, and tribal education departments. And then we work to assist those departments and tribes with their language revitalization efforts. We have partners for all the different languages we work with. We have like a team of organizations and people and organizations within the tribal government that, we all work together on trying to revitalize their language.
The Language Conservancy is currently co-hosting the third annual Mondan Hidatsa Arikara Summer Institute, happening now until July 8th in Newton, North Dakota. There, interested students learn those three endangered native languages through intensive courses by learning how to read, write, and speak those languages.
Our project is a cooperative project between the Language Conservancy, the Nueta Hidatsa Sanish College here in Newtown, as well as the MHA Language and Education Department. Those three organizations kind of put on the Summer Institute, and so it's this kind of cooperative thing that we do here.
Maya says that when the U.S. government instituted boarding schools for Native Americans, shame and resentment was instilled into those children who attempted to speak their first languages. He says that led to a domino effect of anxious parents afraid or even unable to raise their children speaking those languages. That kind of event has a generational effect, according to Maya.
These three languages, Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, are highly endangered. In fact, Mandan only has one fluent speaker left, and probably half a dozen semi-fluent learners and other people. Arikara has fewer speakers even, and mostly just semi-fluent speakers who are learning the language. And Hidatsa has less than 50 speakers.
Maya says many of the remaining fluent native speakers are in their 60s and 70s. He says it takes anywhere from 10 to 20 years to gain the source material and knowledge from those native speakers in order to teach proficient speakers, let alone fluent speakers. But time isn't the only obstacle that Maya says their efforts are up against.
Of course, money is also an important obstacle. It takes a lot of money to bring back a language, and the U.S. government spent on the order of $200 million on its boarding school program to eradicate the languages. So, you know, you can imagine that it would take probably an equivalent amount to truly bring back the native languages in this country.
In their work with their sister organization, the Lakota Language Consortium, Maya says there are now 30 new speakers of the Lakota language, and he says this success is being used to help build similar teaching models with other native languages. It's his hope that it will be successful enough to bring the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara languages back from the brink. For WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford.
WFHB reporter Joshua Fleck provided the reporting for that story.
11 dimly lit intersections across the city will get new streetlights thanks to a lease agreement with Duke Energy, approved by the Board of Public Works last night. Citizen Services Coordinator Christina Smith says the city receives many requests throughout the year from residents asking for better lighting at specific locations. Smith describes the follow-up process.
We go out and what we look for is where the request is. Does it meet our minimal lighting requirements, such as we light intersections along long curve sections, at dead ends or cul-de-sac bulbs. We look at where the existing inventory, existing street lights are at, what kind of service, where it's overhead or underground. I do two on-site visits, one during the day to see what it looks like, if there's any trees or excess foliage that may inhibit the light. Also at night to actually take a look at what it looks like driving and from a pedestrian's perspective.
Also considered, Smith says, is whether the proposed location is at a designated school bus stop, a Bloomington transit stop, or an intersection. Most of the 11 new streetlights will be installed at intersections. On the southwest side of town, new lights will be installed at intersections on Countryside Lane in the vicinity of Summit Elementary School. On the north side, two intersections on 12th Street will receive extra lighting, as well as North Jackson between 13th and 15th Streets. Smith says the city has around 3,000 streetlights, most of which are leased from Duke Energy. The city pays the upfront cost through local road and street funds. Any maintenance is done through a Duke contractor. Councilmember Kelly Boatman noted all the current lights were requested by individual citizens.
Does the city have, or should we have, you know, our own proactive, you know, way of going out and looking for spots that need lights? Or do we always just rely on citizens to bring these to our attention? Do we have a, you know, occasional survey that we do to look, you know, someone's out there looking for trouble spots on roadways?
Smith assured the board the police and fire departments, transit employees, and city planners, as well as the school corporation, all give feedback on areas where more lighting is needed.
June is National Homeownership Month, and in recognition, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, announced the release of over $40 million in house counseling grants to national, regional, and local organizations. Indiana's portion of the grant will be $126,000. Trained counselors will help homebuyers evaluate their readiness for a home purchase, understand their options, and navigate the home buying process. It will also help renters find affordable housing, assist homeless persons in finding transitional housing they need to move toward a permanent place to live, help senior citizens seeking reverse mortgages, and assist borrowers with financial advice and lender negotiations to avoid loss of service or foreclosure. To find a list of HUD-approved counseling agencies, visit HUD's website at www.hud.gov. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Ryan Stacy.
And I'm Maria McKinley. Results from a survey by the Strategic National Arts Alumni Project reveal many skills that are deemed crucial in a variety of business settings that can have their roots in an arts education. Sarah Vaughn spoke with the project's director, Sally Gaskell, about the long-term influences of artistic study.
Bloomington is widely regarded as an artistic oasis, but in many places, artists of various stripes may not get as much support for developing their talents or may feel discouraged by parents and peers from choosing an artistic profession over one that's deemed more secure. But here are some interesting facts about arts and artists. According to the 2014 National Arts Index, a report put out by the arts advocacy organization Americans for the Arts, the self-employed artist entrepreneur is, quote, alive and well, unquote, with total numbers growing across artistic disciplines between 2000 and 2012. According to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, the arts and cultural sector supported 4.7 million jobs in 2012. The National Arts Index says the average compensation is around $53,000 a year. At IU Center for Postsecondary Research, Sally Gaskin has been surveying graduates of arts-intensive high schools and university arts programs as the director of the Strategic National Arts Alumni Project, referred to as SNAP. SNAP reaches out to arts programs and institutions who in turn reach out to their alumni for responses.
The purpose of SNAP is to, first of all, help institutions learn about the careers and educational experiences of their own arts alumni. And second of all, to help the national conversation on what is the value of an arts degree and what are artists doing to contribute to their local communities and economies and their own career paths.
The debate about the value of an arts-inclusive education has been going on for decades, and Gaskin thinks arts programs will always have to fight to justify their existence. Gaskin describes multiple impacts from early artistic training. She cites as an example arts-intensive high schools.
Arts high schools are a concept. Most urban school districts have an arts high school or two. They find that arts high schools are appropriate venues for all sorts of students, both those who have been fortunate enough to have intensive arts training from an early age up through middle school and going into high school, but also those students who may not be successful in other learning environments. So we found that while fewer arts high school graduates plan to have professional careers in the arts than, say, their undergraduate or graduate degree counterparts, so many of those students credit their training as arts high school students to helping their current occupations. One of my favorite quotes is from a graduate of an arts high school in an urban system on the East Coast. And her comment was, "I use the skills that I learned in arts high school every day in my career as a police officer." And she was specifically pointing to understanding how different cultures work, in understanding teamwork and collaboration, improving with feedback, those kinds of things. And certainly critical thinking and analysis. But I would say the number one skill set that all arts graduates look at and find that is important to them is simply creativity. And, you know, frankly, I'm an arts administrator. I used to think that creativity had to be something that you simply had. But in fact, you can learn creative skills in school.
In fact, data from the most recent SNAP survey shows more than 90% of the respondents feel their creative and critical thinking skills are rooted in an arts education. That same 90% cited project management, teamwork, leadership skills, and writing and speaking skills as benefits of artistic training. This was true whether they were currently professional artists or never a professional artist.
We have learned that most artists excel in collaborative and teamwork experiences. So if you think of a musician practicing by herself or himself in a practice room, but that musician also plays in ensembles, and particularly those smaller chamber ensembles have to have a good sense of collaboration and teamwork. Otherwise, you simply fall apart. And certainly, any orchestra conductor will also tell you that teamwork is hugely important to making a good final sound. And I think it's the same in all of the other arts. We find so many arts graduates these days have been experimenting with multidisciplinary work. So a painter is not just a painter anymore. A painter is also someone who dabbles in fiber and or sculpture and or performance art. So all of those kinds of things need collaboration and teamwork to be able to get ahead.
Many even linked entrepreneurial skills to an arts education. I asked Gaskin about the single-minded tenacity it takes to make it as both a business person and an artist. Do you think there's also a correlation between the tenacity it takes to problem solve in the business world and the tenacity it takes to, say, practice an orchestral composition or to stick at a particular problem in any kind of artistic medium?
Most definitely. And you've hit on something that kind of goes into the whole entrepreneurial skill set. So we know that entrepreneurs need to be resilient. Certainly artists do as well. And certainly one thing that we know is that all arts graduates, or nearly all of them, will say that they know how to work on a deadline. Otherwise, they're never going to be successful. So yes, that musician knows how to practice enough to be able to be ready for the performance, just as a visual artist knows what's necessary to work on a piece that needs to be finished. People who are dancers, choreographers, and or theater artists particularly need to be more entrepreneurial. So many of them simply need to found their own companies, and they do. It's becoming more the case in music as well, and not that unusual in all of the other art forms. Entrepreneurship has become something of a buzzword, I would say, in arts and higher education, and that's not really a bad thing, but one of the things that SNAP data has shown is that so many more artists need so much more basic career development and business training while they're in school. Some of them, frankly, are not open to it in school, but the more that there are offerings available, whether they're part of the curriculum or add-ons, we find that artists, once they graduate, they're certainly grateful for whatever training they've had. We also know that local arts councils, other arts service providers in communities, they're also important in terms of delivering that kind of business training and career development training to the artists who work in their communities.
As it turns out, goods produced by artists have contributed to a reduction in the national trade deficit. According to the National Arts Index, exported movies, paintings, jewelry, and other artistic goods increased 17% between 2010 and 2012, delivering a $48 billion trade surplus in 2012. And while the economy grew at a rate of 2.3% per year from 2007 to 2012, the economic contributions of independent artists, writers, and performers grew almost twice as fast, at a rate of 4.4%. So if you're an artist thinking of developing a career, the SNAP survey provides lots of encouraging facts to arm yourself with against the naysayers. And while Bloomington Public Schools have stronger arts programs than many other towns, if you live in an area with fewer options for arts education, it may be time to consider a lobbying effort. Reporting for WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
You can review the Strategic National Arts Alumni Project survey results at snaap.edu. You can find additional research at americansforthearts.org.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing,
offering digital marketing solutions for small businesses. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both a desktop and mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197.
Up next is our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
This week on Voices in the Street, a question of hate. Should punishments increase when crimes are driven by it? The FBI has defined a hate crime as a, quote, criminal offense against a person or property motivated in whole or in part by an offender's bias against a race, religion, disability, sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender, or gender identity, end quote. Indiana is one of five states without hate crime laws on the books, so Voices in the Street asked your friends and neighbors if Indiana should adopt hate crime laws.
I think it would have to depend on how that, like the parameters of the definitions for that particular law that I would want to know about before specifically commenting on it. Because each state can decide how to formulate that law and then actually implement it. So I think it really just depends on the context.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if it's become common practice to have such laws in the United States, then I think Indiana should fall in line with the other states.
Regarding a hate crime law, I think we need to differentiate between physical action and just types of speech, because there's a lot of issues on college campuses regarding when, let's just say, someone says something that's offensive, is that necessarily a hate crime? So let's just say if something physical is actually physically harming a certain individual regarding their sexual orientation or the color of their skin or their religion, that's a circumstance where that could potentially taken into consideration. But a lot of these new laws that people are pressing for are actually being detrimental to the freedoms of speech. So just in terms of saying something that's not necessarily politically correct, so it needn't be more of a physical sense, at least in my particular opinion.
Yes, I think Indiana should have a hate crime law. I think it's really important to make people feel comfortable and safe in their communities and to alert people, inform people about, you know, how minority groups are often treated.
Yeah, I think there should be a hate crime law, 100%. Why wouldn't you have one? The only reason if there's not one in place is because you have a lot of people here who are probably bigots, they're anti-Semitic, or there's something, and they want to keep it that way.
I think there should be at least like some type of fine or like imprisonment of some kind, but just to get the idea spread across that it's not a good thing.
You know, I think in the time that we're in right now, that is a very timely topic, and that we probably really should consider it. I don't know that I have a really strong opinion one way or another, but I certainly think hate crimes are a different category and maybe should have some different punishments.
Honestly, to me, I think if they're doing something like that, the disincentive that a hate crime law would have isn't going to have any effect. They're going to do it anyway.
You know, the issues aren't the weapons that are used. The issue is the heart. And until people just get their lives back on track with the Lord, this will continue. I hate the crimes that have been committed in the name of the Lord, name of Allah, whatever you want to call it. But because that's not what a Christian does, and I'm not sure about the Muslim faith as much. But I've known some, and they seem like nice people. You know what I mean? I don't know. I think all crimes hate, and I won't categorize one as a hate crime and whatnot.
Well, yeah, because if it was a gay person, then that would just, that's wrong, because I got a grandma that's gay, so I wouldn't like it very much.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, Community Radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Joshua Fleck and Casey Ross, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, our partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Sarah Vaughn.
Voices in the Street was produced by Kelly Worley. Our engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Ryan Stacey.
And I'm Maria McKinley. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.